I'm Matt Godbolt.
And I'm Ben Rady.
And this is Two's Compliment, a programming podcast. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Matt.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Glad to hear it. So, we've been talking a bit about performance, and I've realized that kind of my career has taken me from hacking around an assembly through to trying to coerce compilers into doing all the work for me, right? That seems to be the journey that I've taken. And I realized that there are people still that are much, much better at making the compiler do all the heavy lifting for us than I am. And so I figured we should talk to somebody who can tell us all about the kinds of things you can do if you really, really work hard at the compiler and some of the tricks you can do with C++.
Okay, yeah, well, that sounds cool.
So?
And so we have a guest today?
We have a guest. We have a guest. There's another window on our screen, which no one else can see, obviously. But so surprise to nobody on this call, but surprise to our listeners, we have a very special guest today. We're joined by Hanna Dusikova. Hi, Hanna.
Hi.
How you doing?
Thank you so much for agreeing to do this. We are excited to have you here.
It's too late here, but it's great. And last few days was kind of up and down, so I'm great.
Oh, good. Right. I'm glad to hear that. And thank you as well for dealing with the time zone difference. Mm-hmm. We're happily in our lovely early afternoon, whereas you're way into your evening. So we appreciate you taking the time for then. So I just want to introduce you to our guests. I want to introduce us to our listeners. Yes, you are our guest. You can see how often we do this. Yeah. So Hanna, you're a staff scientist at Avast, and you represent the Czech national body for C++, right? Is that the right way to say that?
Yeah, that's correct. And also I'm an officer in C++ committee. I'm chairing SG7, which is a study group for compile-time programming and static reflection.
That's not a sci-fi series, right?
I thought No.
I figured
maybe it's some prequel to Terminator, probably.
Oh, right. Well, we'll get to that in a minute, I'm sure. But yeah, I'm always confused because WG21 is the C++ Standards Committee? Is that what its name is?
Yeah, it's Working Group 21.
And then SG is Special Group?
Or Study what? Group.
Study Group. Okay, so your SG7, which is compile-time programming, and what was the second part?
And static reflection.
Static reflection. Wow, these are all sound like very exciting things that I want now in my programming language.
So I think it's really a boring topic.
But that's now you tell us. We just invited you here to talk about these kind of. Well, we talk about all things, but
We talk about a lot of the boring stuff on this podcast. Other people seem to find it interesting. I don't understand why, but this is just Matt and I talking about the stuff that we always talk about.
I mean, we can just listen to Matt talking, and it's exciting. I think at CPPCon, Matt, you did like 30 minutes stand-up comedy. Was it CPPCon?
I don't think that's true. I mean, maybe that you just thought that my presentation was just so funny. But no, well, yeah. I think you
did great because you cannot like you didn't have any feedback, and you just go.
Well, normally the feedback is, please stop talking, we've had enough. Or at least that's what I read on people's faces.
But, no.
Bless you. So my understanding is when you're not hacking on C++ and dealing with all the committee stuff, you're also a keen photographer and a greyhound owner. But there's something cool about the kind of photography you do, right?
Yeah, I'm doing panoramic photography. It's like these spherical pictures, like Google Earth, before Google Earth was cool, actually.
Right, uh-huh.
And it's quite technical. So it's not like a typical photography. You need to have like tripod. You need to have like a special head for that, and also white lens. And you need to take, I think, usually 30 pictures, and make sure no one is moving, going between pictures. Because then someone is cut in half and it looks
Or you
not
get
great.
Two copies of the dog that was running at the same time through your picture, right?
Yeah, exactly. But you can also like erase them if they move between pictures. There is like always some overlap. So you can like remove all picture, like almost whole crowd.
That's amazing.
And if you have time and patience.
Well, Which it strikes me is if you're writing C++, especially the kind of template-y C++ that perhaps one writes, you might have a lot of spare time and patience.
Yeah, right.
So what got you into panoramic photography? Because I remember once taking photographs like with my handheld and like using some photo panorama stitching software to kind of put it together. Is that the same kind of thing, but just more?
Yeah, what? It's actually really similar. And it's the technical part is to rotate your lens around a nodal point in a lens. So yep. There is no parallax error. And then it's really simple.
Oh, I see.
So this is like the center of the tripod creates a point, and the lens is always around
exactly.
As opposed to just turning the lens and then the point.
Yeah.
That makes sense. That's interesting.
Usually, when you do panorama with like mobile phone, you like take it in your hand and do like stuff like this.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's hard to like to describe in podcast. So.
Yeah, no, but the thing where you hold your phone out and slowly pan it from one side to the other.
It makes error, but actually Google is using it in Android to extract depth from pictures.
Oh gosh,
interesting.
I had no idea they were doing so much. Like I just take photographs, and then every now and then Google Photos says, "Hey, I made a panorama out of four photographs you just happened to take together that looked like they could have been put together." And like I have no idea how they do that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but like my approach is a bit different. Mm-hmm. It's not machine learning at all. It's just processing power, and it's a lot of gigapixels.
And you've sent me some images before that have barely almost crashed my browser because they're so huge. So what kind of resolutions are we talking about?
We are talking about limits of a JPEG.
Right. JPEGs have limits? What are they
It's 16,000 something, and it depends on implementation.
These are UINT 16 somewhere as like a width and height.
Interesting.
Well, today I learn.
And there is actually a funny thing. Not every implementation supports a whole specification of JPEG. Mm-hmm. And it depends about last five pixels. That's the like difference between good implementation and bad implementation. The last five pixels is like in middle of the the square in JPEG.
The macro blocks, right? There are 16 by 16 or whatever.
Yeah, and not every implementation is able to handle it.
How peculiar! I would have thought this was a completely solved problem by now, but you know, obviously not.
Yeah, I found out when I tried to load JPEG in Apple Preview. And it was only gray, nothing else.
That's amazing. I just thought, you know, a JPEG is a JPEG. I know it's a complicated format, and I'm really excited by like the clever tricks that JPEG uses to sort of get the compression levels that it does. But I didn't realize that there was much space left over for them to get things wrong. Turns out this computing lark is pretty difficult, after all, getting things right.
Yeah. Then I asked Sean Parent that.
Like, this is Sean Parent of Adobe Photoshop fame, right?
Yeah. You should invite him here
right.
too. He has always some story, and he told me that he makes sure that the JPEG and decoder in Photoshop makes all the corner cases, and it was really hard.
So have you been sending him test images now, or was it already handling all of these things? Right,
not to him, but to Tony Van Eer.
Yep.
He's working on a projection, and he asked me for some big picture. So I sent him one of them, and he told me it crashed their application, and he needed some fixes.
That's really cool. I mean, images, right? I know, you know, every now and then, I say, like, you crash browsers, like, you load up a big image. Like, I'm fond of looking at these high-resolution, similar panorama, actually similar technology, funnily enough, where people have decapped silicon, so you use acid to etch off the top of the chip, and then you use a microscope and you take loads and loads of photographs really highly zoomed in, and then you stitch together the die shot of the chip, and it's super cool because now you can start reading off how the chip actually worked for, you know, like 6502 era technology at least that's the stuff that I can tractably look at and get some idea what's going on. But those images typically are, you know, like they're PNGs, and they are, you know, 60 60,000 by 60,000. And so, yeah, you load them into your browser. And it, of course, the browser immediately shrinks it down because it knows it can't fit that into memory. But then it's kind of coming down like an old school modem, you know, 14K4 modem. You're like, why on earth in this day and age is it taking so long for an image to come down? And then it kind of goes, boom, and it's like Chrome's dead. And you're like, oh, yeah, yeah. I see.
Or sometimes, again, in Apple Preview, you can open the image. It's totally fine. And when you zoom it, it's suddenly gray. And if you unzoom it, it's still gray.
Oh, and gray is like, I've stopped responding gray.
Yeah, probably.
I see.
Yeah.
Right. That's like, I know Ubuntu does this thing where, you know, sometimes if the application's not listening anymore, it's like, well, I'm going to render what the last picture you had, but like in black and white to show the user that you're not, the picture's there, but the application isn't.
Yeah.
It's funny. Yeah. And it is, I mean, it's really interesting, these things, because, you know, we, in our sort of day jobs, we, well, I speak for myself and maybe for Ben here, and obviously, Hannah, your jobs are probably very different, but like memory is kind of something we don't worry about as much anymore. Like we work on server-side stuff for trading, so, you know, we just put more RAM in the machines and we're fine, right? But when you're dealing with images that are as large as that, you have to write your software differently. You don't necessarily want to or can even rely on, say, the virtual memory system doing a good job, because it can't possibly page things in and out as well as you can if you know how your software is going to access the image in the first place. And I don't think I'd ever really thought about that.
I think this applies to every domain. If you know, if you knew a semantic of your algorithm well enough, you will always be better than some generic algorithm.
I guess so. And
that's probably true.
So talking of knowing more about your domain, and a very gramophone reed needle scratch noise segue here, one of the really cool things that I know you do is work on, as we say in the intro, some compile time programming things. And you're most well known for, or at least I know you most well through, a regular expression library, the compile time regular expression library.
No, that's not true. I'm actually most well known for my slides.
That is also true, yes. But the slides, if I'm not wrong, are the things that explain the tricks that you use in your CTRE library.
Yeah, that's
so true. Yeah, we should let you know. We'll put some things in the notes about this, but Hannah's slides are absolutely legendary and have basically changed the way people do presentations in the C++ space, because they are super interactive. And she'll show like a parse tree of a, you know, what looks like a photograph or a picture, a nice rendered picture of a parse tree of a regular expression, including like this is this node, this type, there, here's the multiple of this one or whatever, that kind of like tree view. And then everyone's like, oh, this is cool. Now we can see how this works. And then she'll like single step through a matching a string and different things are highlighted. And you're like, so far, so you just hacked this in PowerPoint and you've just done all of it manually. And then she'll just edit live. Give me a regular expression and she'll type it in and the whole tree changes and it's like live updating all the stuff. It's the best. So
that's pretty amazing.
I mean, yeah, it's definitely something to aspire to. I know when I did a redo of our presentation on like memory accesses, I spent a whole bunch of time trying to do similar highlighting of like, this is where the cache comes in and this bit lights up and then this cache line lights across like this.
Yeah,
you remember that presentation, right? And
yes,
it's, you know,
I do,
it's a
yep.
pale imitation of what Hannah is able to do. So Hannah, how are you doing all of that stuff? And
I'm actually programming it.
Right.
So I implemented a really simple version and a really hacky version of regular expression matching in JavaScript too, just to be able to hook them into D3 library to draw the nice diagrams and visualize it. And I spent a lot of month.
You re-implemented the same thing you'd written in C++
yes.
in your own particular style, which we'll talk about in a second about why it's so cool that you've done it that way.
Wow.
You wrote it in JavaScript again, just so that you could draw the slides to then tell you as to how you did the C++ version.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
Because it was less work than making slides like with some animations, because then I change something and I need to like redo everything. Oh, no way.
Right. That's I
was going to say, and I guess because of the nature of the library, it would be difficult to like transpile that, right? Like with what is the thing that I'm thinking of?
GraphViz?
No. Like the regular expression, you re-implemented the regular expression library to make this work in JavaScript, yes?
Yes.
So like there, I don't know why I'm blanking on the name of this thing right now, but there's this, the tool that you can use to basically compile
C++, you know, into JavaScript, so like WASM stuff, Kripkin, I think is thinking of, I'm blanking on it, mScripton and so on.
But the whole point is that you're doing compiler tricks to make that work. So it's like the chances of that being supported by the, you know, WASM compiler is basically zero, right?
The thing is, the WASM compiler will happily do it. It's just that the everything happens at compile time. Exactly. So you have to actually put the compiler in the web page in order to then actually change it.
Of course. Yes. It's too late.
Who would be daft enough to put a compiler on a web page anyway? It's stupid.
So you actually, for like visualization of the compile time library, you need to have runtime library with hooks to draw it. So it's a different engine.
Tell us about the compile time nature of it. And bear in mind, you know, like, I'm pretty good at the C++ stuff. Ben has got a working knowledge, and we don't really assume that our listeners have much of a thing. We try and draw them from a wide community. So what is compile time programming?
Okay.
And why should we even know? Why should we care, I guess?
Okay, since I learned about C++, at first, I didn't like templates.
This is why we can be friends.
Super complex, hard. Yeah, exactly. And then I read somewhere that they are actually Turing complete. Mm-hmm. So, someone in some article jokingly said, you should be able to make regular expression in templates.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And it bothered me in my mind somehow. How I would do that? And I was thinking, like, through many years, I was like experimenting with some parts only. Like, then I finally was able to match only like a string against another string, and then I learned more and more, and then suddenly I was able to match regular expression, but not like regular expression in string, but like express as a template, like the expression tree of the regular expression, but encoded as a template or type name in C++. So it's like repeat, angle brackets, string, character one, character B, character
C. Got it.
And
so you had to kind of, as a programmer writing the regular expression, you actually had to write the encoded regular expression as the tree that it would ultimately be, rather than just the string that we know and love, maybe? Love? Yeah, I don't know, regular expressions.
Tolerate. Yeah. We love and tolerate. We know and tolerate.
And actually, I like the form because it's more expressive than like regular expression, which is like
what's going on. They're very terse, aren't they? And that's it's nice if I can just imagine seeing one of these and knowing that one of the things that you could put in this are comments inside your regular expression in C style comments, so at least explain what on earth's going on, which is harder to do, at least with the standard regular expressions.
Yes, exactly. And then I was thinking how to convert a string into this form. Mm-hmm. And that's simple L1 parser and just
simple. You've just said simple. You glossed over something which is very challenging.
The only data structure you have in template metaprogramming is a stack.
Okay.
You can have type list, and you can add a type in front and remove type from front. That's all you have.
So this is kind of very Lisp-like primitives that you have access to, right?
And but when you have stack, you're actually doing complete, and you can do whatever you want.
Wow. I don't think I registered that was the only thing you really needed in order to be able to do this kind of stuff.
I mean, for Turing complete, you need to have two stacks, but
Okay, right. And just to be clear, right, the thing that you're sort of stacking here is that you're making a new type which is specialized in different ways, and you're concatenating onto a type. So this is all in the type system of the compiler. There is no actual stack that you're manipulating that's going to be in your runtime program. It's all in the compiler at compile time. So
it's a type, and if you add a type representing your current state in a parser, and then you add a type representing one character on input.
Right.
And it modifies to another type which represent different state of parser, and then you apply this repeatedly in a recursion way in a function.
Yep.
And at the end, it will return you a result which will give you only this is a regular expression, this is not a regular expression. That's like step one.
Okay.
Then you are like.
So then, let me just try to run that past you again. So you build, you're parsing this thing in, you're building this type up, and it's sort of pushing and popping as you're.
Yeah.
Following the LALR parser rules. And at the end, it either succeeds and you get back, do you get back a bool, or do you just get back a type that is the tag type of saying this is a valid regular expression or this is not a valid regular expression?
You can
or...
fail in multiple fashion. You can fail in some horrible error in compiler. Also, you can propagate boolean that the regular expression is wrong. And right. Then you can have only one static assert checking the boolean and with a nice error, this is wrong, this is an incorrect regular expression.
I see. So static assert is an assertion that runs at compile time, right? It's just either true or false. And there's a compiler error if the whatever you pass to the static error is not a constant known at compile time and true.
Yeah, it must be known at compile time.
Right. Right, right.
And then next step, when you have a parser...
Okay, so this is just the beginnings.
Yeah,
okay,
exactly.
Right.
And then next step is to have some like context as a third parameter during parsing, another stack where you, based on the symbol in the grammar, do some modification on the stack.
Okay, so you've got one that's just like the parse stack, which you were using just to sort of like keep track of where you are, how many open parens and closed parens, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And the other one is kind of where you're putting... I'm guessing this is going to be like where the actual sort of compiled regular expression is going to...
Like typical expression grammar, you can have like number and then action plus came. And you take two items from top of the stack and wrap them into number. Into plus operation. And the plus operation is actually can easily map to the first stage, the regular expression as an expression. Template expression. So you have like concatenation. So there is an operator concatenation. Then you just take two elements from the top of the stack, wrap them, and place them back to the stack.
Okay, so it's like a stack machine that you would write if you're like even like if you're writing like a maths, very simple math parser type thing. You know, push two. Add.
Or if you've ever used a TI calculator.
Or a Texas Instruments calculator from that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but instead, multiplying numbers from input, you actually store the operation with the numbers itself.
Okay. So you kind of just keep it as that. You don't actually add them. You say this is an addition operation with one and one or whatever the equivalent is.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the input is actually from the grammar. The LL1 parser will give it to you as a stream of operations in postfix notation.
Okay, yep.
So then it's just two atoms, concatenation, atom, concatenation, atom, concatenation. And then you have another sub-expression. And then at the end, there is a multiple options or and.
Right.
And then you will have the regular expression as a tree. As a type.
Got it.
Then you can easily run because you just call the operator evaluate over the type and it will go recursively in all branches. And at the end, it will give you true or false if the input matches this regular expression.
So this time, at this point, we have transitioned from compile time to runtime, right? So that the...
Yes.
Again, right, I'm just going to read this back to you to make sure I've got this straight because my head is spinning, but the... The result of the parse is accumulated into the second stack that you're talking about, which effectively ends up being a bespoke type who is only responsibility in the entire world is to hold the compiled operations that will match the regular expression that was given, right? So if I say
it's
A or
thing.
B, a tree representation of the A and the B and the or something-ish like that. And then that type, I can now at runtime give a string... And it will do the matching of A or B in this instance. That's amazing because presumably that means if I make a mistake, I think, well, as you just said, if I make a mistake in my regular expression, I don't have to wait till runtime for the thing to throw an exception saying, oh, by the way, that's not valid. It happens at compile time.
But that's actually the first phase.
Right, that's the bit we were just talking about before with the Boolean or the tag type, right.
Yeah.
And then, so what implications does this have for... And what's the difference between, say, you know, me just using a normal regular expression?
Your compiler knows everything you are doing, and it can inline everything, and it's actually going down to assembly, compare, read.
So it really does net out all this sort of very complicated sounding, highfalutin type-based stuff. Once it's all boiled down to actual code generation... The compiler just essentially writes the handwritten code that you would have done yourself if you were said, okay, this needs to match either A or B.
Yeah.
And it's just the two compares and an or whatever, and we're done. Wow.
My like first approach, because I wanted regular expressions in really performant one, I was thinking about using LLVM to write the code and use LLVM optimizer. Mm-hmm. But
right.
LLVM is really hard to understand and get into. So I knew C++, so I write it in C++, kind of, and then optimizer will do it for me anyway.
So you still get to use LLVM. If you're compiling with Clang, you really are using LLVM. Yeah. It's just that you're using it through the medium of normal C++. As opposed to, like you were saying, if you were to, you could use LLVM directly yourself, in which case you'd build up nodes and you'd then build a DAG and you'd build the comparison operations and the basic blocks that are doing the compares and whatever. And then you'd say to LLVM, hey, can you generate me the assembly for that? Which would still be, which would allow you to do some of that at runtime, I suppose, which is the only advantage that you might need if you actually wanted to have dynamic regular expressions, which is usually a security risk, right? If you let somebody type in a regular expression, you're probably doing it wrong, like runtime.
I think even evaluating a regular expression at runtime is a security risk.
Right, because depending on the regular expression, you could have some absolutely catastrophic backtracking stuff going on where it
not
could just blow out this.
You can just run out of stack.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right, I suppose so. It's potentially unbounded, right. I don't think I thought about that. That's actually mildly terrifying, given that my website is entirely regular expression based in terms of all of the horrible things
that it does. Yeah, but it's mostly running at our clients, so it should be fine.
Oh, yeah. No, there's plenty of stuff that's going on the server, unfortunately.
Okay, good luck.
But, you know, like, I don't think a regular expression overrun or stack smash is my biggest source of security risk, given that I just take arbitrary bits of user code and run them on my servers. So, you know, anyway, that's
also true.
Yeah,
facts.
So that's amazing. So compile time is letting us push stuff that would traditionally be done with like a static offline parser generator stuff, and then a code generator, like you said, like LLVM, or even just writing your own stuff, and being able to hoist it into mostly sane looking C++. You know, like I have a very low threshold for template metaprogram trickery.
From,
and
like from user perspective, it's just CTRE, match, angle brackets, and in angle brackets, there is a regular expression as you know it. And
so from a user's point of view, it looks, it's just a very slightly different way of looking at use, like the angle brackets instead of the round brackets.
I think Quarantine said that they are called HANA brackets because of that, but...
HANA brackets. Oh, well, that's what I'm going to call them. We've had all sorts of funny names for the things over the time. Like I'll call them chevrons, you know, like the things that like are... and then operator like this, and no one can see this, of course, on the podcast, but I'm doing like two crocodile hands facing one way is like the output operator, and then the other way is the input operator. And and then a good friend.
So this is like alligator and this is crocodile?
Something
is
like
that.
Yeah, I don't know how that works. So what do you call that? I mean, we've stopped using these except for their, you know, as nature intended to shift variables around, you know, bit shift stuff. That's the right thing. Hopefully everyone's using FMT, libfmt nowadays for any kind of actual string manipulation. And then the only other one that springs to mind is something that a colleague of mine and Ben's used to call mummy and daddy duck and their baby ducks, which is whenever you have to use double ampersands and then the dot 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 in a template list. It's, you know, amp dot dot dot, and it's like the two mummy and daddy ducks and then their little little baby ducks. And I think now I can't unsee that now. Every time, it's not very often I write code that needs that level of like thing, but it's there. I don't. What do you call that? It's like a variadic R value.
It's perfect forwarding. And variadic pack of packs for running arguments.
Gosh, that sounds like a tongue twister. A variadic pack of...
probably incorrect, and probably someone from core will said to me, you should call it universal references, you should call it R value references. Oh, no. No, it's not
R value
references.
Stop talking about it. Double duck.
Yeah.
Double duck operator.
Double duck is the best.
Yeah. I think it's right. No, that's cool. So, I mean, other things. I mean, regular expressions are probably the only the beginning of this, right? In terms of like very small grammars that make sense to be able to compile into a program. You know, we've all kind of realized that string matching is painful if you have to write it yourself. And regular expressions, for all the warts that we were joking about earlier, they can be a very efficient way of encoding something you want to get done. And certainly CTRE gives you a pragmatic way of saying, here's a string matching thing that everyone understands, and yet I don't have to pay any kind of runtime performance costs. I get perfect assembly output that's going to match it as fast as anyone could possibly write handwritten stuff. What else can we do?
Yeah, I was going to say, like, does this general technique, I mean, obviously for regular expressions, you've got this library, but does this mean that you can do more things generally at compile time using this technique? Like, you know, I can imagine, like, you know, a few situations in which you might want to have other things calculated at compile time and be like, oh, it'd be super cool if I could have a regular expression here, but I can't because it's too early in the process. And I mean, I don't know. That's sort of just my naive impression. But does this open the door to more of those kinds
you
of things?
You can calculate anything you want if you don't have any input output, and we are working on inputs too, so you can actually open a file, read it, and then do some transformation, and then store it in your binary or generate code based on it. It's from Jean Heat embed.
The std embed thing, right?
Yeah.
Okay. This is long. You know, one has always wanted to have like a configuration file kind of thing where, you know, you want to have something which isn't code necessarily, but does go into the code. That's a brilliant way of doing it. I can just imagine, you know, JSON parsers, YAML parsers, things being able to generate bespoke types, potentially. I mean, template-based types, I guess.
YAML, not YAML. Please.
Not YAML. Why? I like YAML. What's wrong with YAML, Hannah?
You need to write parser for it, and then I will ask again.
Okay. All right, subset of YAML. I get that the ampersand thing that lets you refer to other parts is probably very, very tricky, but maybe there's something else I'm not thinking of. Yeah, all right. But I don't like JSON. Can I just say it out loud, right? It's not very fashionable. I know JSON is like the lingua franca of everything, but like I can't put comments in JSON, and that makes it really hard for me to write anything where I'm explaining why some, you know, like package.json for like a node project, right? You have to have a package.json. It has to be valid JSON. Not only does it have to be exactly valid JSON, like I can't have a trailing comma and I have to always quote everything all the time. I can't explain that I bumped a package version. Please don't do, you know, this is why this is here. I don't directly depend on this package. I want package, but I need version 3. Otherwise I get a security warning. And I can't put a comment on the line saying, I don't care about this package, but it needs to be 3 or greater. Or something like that. And there's just written everywhere. And I know I used to have a trick where I would always just put an extra key of like under comment, under quote. And then I could put a comment in the middle of a dictionary and just hope that no one cared that there was the thing. Anyway, rant about JSON over.
I think actually like parsing JSON is like 200 lines of code in C++. I recently write one. So
yeah. That, I mean, I've heard, I know, you know, Ben Dean and ironically, of course, Jason Turner did a presentation a long while ago on parsing JSON. And I kind of like, it feels like that's great and it shows the technique off, but I would never want to do that because I hate JSON so much. Well, I like Jason Turner, just to be clear, if you listen to this. But
JSON the person, Jason, not JSON the file just, format.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I'm wondering what other things. I mean, could one write a C compiler?
What?
I think someone did already.
Get out.
A few years ago, there was someone on Reddit with context per C compiler.
That's absolutely daft. I love it. I mean, I've seen people with, you know, the brain language, brain F language that I won't swear on our podcast, but that one, I've seen that. That kind of makes sense. I can see how that could go together, even like with my primitive understanding of template trickery.
But actually, it's not template metaprogramming. It's actually ConcextPer.
Yeah, go on. Tell us about, so what's the difference between template and ConcextPer?
Yeah, template metaprogramming is actually abusing the properties of the language. They came with templates to make easier write some containers and etc. And then someone found they are actually Turing complete.
I see. So that was never intentional.
No, that's not never intentional.
My naive thing of like, I want, you know, I want to write an array of, or a vector, an expanding array of type T, that's what I think of templates, right? And you're like, well, that's not Turing complete. That's just like fill in the dots with the T in all the places. Yeah, right.
Then there is a context pair programming, which is just really bad name for this function should or may be invalidated in compile time. And then you are writing just ordinary C++. So you can like actually write a really easy code, really simple code. And mostly, in most cases, you can just add a context modifier to all your function and it will work anyway. So if you implement that C compiler, just mark everything context and it should probably work.
Wow. That's where we've come along from. So what used was a kind of amusing hack that was discovered by folks back in the day of like, hey, this is accidentally Turing complete, which I mean, I think so many things in life end up being accidentally Turing complete, right? To constexpr being sort of brought into the language as a way of tagging just normal functions. And if I remember rightly, the first few editions of languages, the language that had constexpr, it was super limited. You could only like have a single return statement.
They were afraid of that.
They were afraid of this. And so you could write your constexpr multiply two numbers together, which was, you know, constexpr int multiply int a int b return a star b. That was all you could do. And you go, oh, there you are. That's really exciting. I was like, well, what does that help me here? And
you could do recursion, but you can do conditions. No, you can do any like cycles. Then they allow it, and they allow it more in C++20. We allowed allocations, so you can actually allocate. You can use a set vector now. You can
in
use
constexpr time. So this is just a normal C++ program that's running in the compiler effectively, and the output of it can then be used in things that are in the compiled program. Wow.
You actually cannot return set vector from the function to out from the compile time because there is like a problem that if you allocate something in compile time, but it will live in a runtime.
I see.
So there is like the
dynamic allocation that you did during compile time can't live on into the lifetime of the program because it's not dynamic anymore, right? How do you delete the memory that was like, well, it was in the compiler?
Yeah, right. All your allocation must be freed when you are leaving the constant evolution context.
Right.
But you can use it inside of your function to make the algorithms much easier, simpler than just using templates and tricks.
I see.
You can actually implement your own stack with vector.
With actual normal code rather than like consing on the side of some Lisp-like thing that's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And so you're no longer abusing the type system to hold the internal state of your algorithm. You can just use freaking variables, right? like a normal person would do. That's so cool.
Exactly. And then you can implement the parser in much more ordinary way. And it will be much faster. And I mean, not like one magnitude, but like exponential versus linear.
And this is what, runtime speed, or are you talking compile time speed? So the compiler itself is much better at, I don't know, understanding the code that it normally reads all day, every day to compile our code than it is dealing with the abuse of the template system and all the instantiations that requires.
Yeah, for example, if you have like a expression which is a few kilobyte long, which is crazy, by the way.
I've seen the ones for like the match email addresses and they look a bit like that.
Yeah. And if you try to compile it with a CTRE, I don't know if it will ever end. And it usually it crashes on insufficient memory.
Right, I can imagine. Because of all
the... Then I made a prototype of CTRE using constexpr parsing, which is like limiting also the template instantiation. And then I tried a few megabytes long regular expression, and it took like half second or something to compile.
That's such a big deal. That is huge. Yeah, like we've talked a lot, Ben and I. One of the things, the themes of this podcast is like my impatience at waiting for code to build, and Ben's impatient waiting for tests to run. Right, that's our shtick here.
That's kind of true. Yeah,
and so. Having tools in our toolbox that allow us to use these advanced techniques that are coming down the pipeline or even here already that don't also suck in compile time is very important to me and close to my heart. So I'm really excited to hear these. That's amazing.
And you can actually easily test your code.
I was going to ask. And,
yeah, exactly. And your code won't ever compile if it's like, if there is any problem. You can just run it in compile time and place it into static assert, like a require in test, and if you are okay, it will compile. If not, your compilation will fail.
So the compiler runs the test implicitly as it's compiling. Yeah. That sounds like Ben's heaven.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's like, so the answer to the question of should I check things with the compiler or should I check things with test is yes.
Yes, both. All of the above. Yes. I mean, that's great.
But actually, you should test both. In C++ 20, you can actually have different code which will be run in compile time and in runtime in same function.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, this is something I wanted to talk about, actually. That is that one of the things about constexpr is that any code you write that's constexpr can also be run dynamically. So, for example, if you call a function like my multiply routine that I just sort of said, and you needed it at compile time, the compiler will obviously evaluate it with all the constants available and promise you that, like, you know, you've got an array of size 10 because you did 2 times 5, right? End of story. But if you call it with dynamic parameters, it will just generate the code and do it like normal. So and then Hannah's just reminded us that you can now ask the compiler, am I being evaluated inside the compiler or am I being evaluated at runtime? Like, am I in the matrix or not?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you can change the answer, which of course is like terrifying.
And you shouldn't do that. You shouldn't do that.
You shouldn't do that. So when might... All right, you said you shouldn't do it, but why would you need to know?
Yeah, sometimes it's really hard to implement something in constexpr limitation. It's usually recursive algorithms, but in runtime you can use some intrinsic, for example.
I see.
Or inline assembly.
I see. So, like, for example, if I had a matrix multiply routine, 4x4 matrix multiply routine, then of course I want to be able to do that at constexpr because who knows, I might be rotating some points or something that's in a big list of things. But if I'm running on the real-time system, I actually want to use the underlying x86 architectural instructions myself to do it. So you need to be able to switch on that.
So you can have like two paths, one for compiler and one for your runtime.
So back to your point that you made, which is that, you know, having the compiler run your test is fine, provided you don't have any code that differs. But if you do have code that differs, you should also test it with the normal techniques. Which brings me on to the next question I have actually about this, which is how do you debug this? Because I'm used to putting breakpoints and printfs everywhere, and I don't think the compiler lets me do that. Question. Or maybe it does.
Yeah, there is no tooling for that. And like one trick I found is to create a template which is not defined. It's like only declared. Mm-hmm. If I'm correct.
Okay, so you just say, there exists a thing called Bob, but you don't give a body. So it's like the compiler can't do anything with Bob if you try to do...
Hey, it's actually template type name, something, struct Bob.
Okay, so Bob is... Yeah, sorry, this is a terrible name. I use Bob for anything, or Ian is the other one. But Bob is of T, right? And you know, so you've got a T that you can give it. Okay.
And if you try to instantiate it somewhere, like it's like... print for debugging.
Yeah.
It will fail in compilation, and it will tell you there is no instance of
print for debugging of, and then whatever you put inside the. You can do your you can throw an exception kind of thing with a helpful message, but the helpful message unfortunately is just a type name inside a deliberately left out bodied.
This is like good for debugging, but for like when I wrote CTRE, I start from the parser and I wrote a lot of tests to make sure it's working properly, and then I built on that. So when I change something, it will immediately break, so I know something is not right, and that helps. So obviously, test helps.
Well, that's very on brand for us. So I'm glad to hear that. Even when the compiler is doing all the work for you. Testing is useful, but
yeah, you're actually writing a code, so you need to test it. If you won't test it, then it's like meaningless.
Absolutely.
So how long until we have a template programming language testing framework?
I think Catch2 already has like some like macros which will force evaluating something in compile time to check it. So there are definitely already some tools.
All right.
Like but in CTRE, I was lazy, and my tests are actually a bunch of static asserts. And if any of the CPP file fails to compile, then there is a problem.
Right, right.
And every time I get some like issue or mostly issues, then I try to like make it happen, the problem, and then I fix it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
If I try to fix it before that, I don't know what I fixed.
Yeah, that never works out. Got to watch it fail first.
Yeah. Start exactly. from a failing test, you know, and then work backwards. Otherwise,
So actually, it's exactly the same as normal programming.
Right,
but
exactly.
Just like awkward.
Yeah. I guess I've gotten so lazy with debuggers, like actual like GDB and whatever, that I'm so, you know, I'll happily write something without testing it as much as perhaps I ought to, or at least certainly if I'm trying to understand someone else's code. You can really do far wrong than single stepping through and going to go and getting the feel of it. And I feel like there would perhaps there's tooling for that that would be useful. Can I?
I think you can always hook into compiler with GDB.
That's true. If you can understand what's going on inside GDB inside GCC using GDB, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me that you can understand that, Hunter, frankly.
No, but I definitely can't.
Oh, I have to ask, by the way. There is a library called HANA already that's a template metaprogramming library. Are you who was first? Who stole it? Were you before the library, or were you named after the library?
I was born before the library.
Yeah, and then they stole your name.
No. There is no connection at all.
I find that hard to believe. I mean, there's certainly some nominative determinism going on here. Surely, you know, you're now the part.
It took me a while. At CPQ1, I did my lightning talk about CTRE, and people were like talking like, you must know Louis.
That's right. It's Louis' library, right? Yeah.
Out of Busdana, and no, what's going on? I didn't know.
So you didn't know that there is a big compile time sort of pre-processory. I don't even know what HANA is. I'll be honest with you. I know you, but
it's like a style of program, using templates, but without you actually using knowing that you are using templates.
I see.
Like function argument deduction tricks.
Okay.
And last week. We had maybe this week. I'm not sure anymore.
you had no idea what time it is or what day. Yeah.
We had a study group 7 meeting, mm-hmm. and we were discussing like future of reflection, and we were reminding people that Boost HANA style or HANA style function were rejected.
Right, and there's you saying this, right?
Mm-hmm. No, it wasn't David actually, but it's funny.
But no, literally no connection. That's funny. It is amusing.
Maybe it was prophecy.
Maybe it was prophecy. Take it as prophecy. That seems like a great point mm-hmm. to end on here as we've got to time. But thank you so much for being with us today. This has been really, really interesting. And I think I've finally gotten... I mean, so full disclosure before now, I've been to several of HANA's presentations on this kind of stuff, and I've never really had it stick in my head the way, even when...
No. Matt was my remote clicker.
So before it was fashionable to do presentations remotely, HANA was ahead of the curve. I forget, what was the reasoning you...
My flight was cancelled. I couldn't go to the conference. I did my presentation remotely, but something failed with remote control of his computer because I wanted to run slides on Matt's computer because there are like animations and everything. I was supposed to control it with VNC, but somehow it fails. Matt was my clicker, so I was telling him like next slide. And then... there was like the audience, and there was the slide with the tree, the expression tree. And I asked Matt, click on the text box and write some expression.
So I got to be do the cool thing with the presentation and take all the glory. And then poor Hano did all the work.
No,
that was fun.
Oh, man.
That was fun. But
and that was actually a funny conference. And yeah, Yeah, Matt is my clicker.
That's my... I've peaked in my career now. I've been HANA's clicker. And I was very proud to be. All right, friends. Well, once again, HANA, thank you so much for your time and for explaining this all to me. As I say, I think I have a much better understanding now than I think I've had before.
And thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, this is great. Super interesting.
You've been listening to Two's Compliment, a programming podcast by Ben Rady and Matt Godbolt. Find the show transcript and notes at twoscompliment.org
contact us on Twitter at 2CP, that's at TWOSCP.
Theme music by Inverse Phase, inversephase.com.